you've got one there. I'll get one here.
What's your second name?
Lionel.
Yeah. This is a report of interview with Rear Admiral... Dan. I was thinking of the second name. Lionel? Dan Lionel Hannington. You know how to spell Dan's name, Omar. Royal Canadian Navy, retired in Halifax. Well, thanks for fitting me in, Dan. We've had a wonderful few days here. When did you first join the Navy and why? Not when did you first join the Navy, when did you join the Navy?
I joined the Navy in July of 1940. I had been going to join the Air Force, but my favorite schoolmaster at Rothsay Collegiate School, his name was George Wally, joined the Navy and disappeared into the Royal Navy on loan and got mixed up in the sinking of the Bismarck, and thereafter went to small boats and designed small boats in the Admiralty small boat section, and he won himself, the DSC, certainly the Royal Humane Society medal, and I thought if it was good enough for George, it was good enough for me.
Is this George Wally, who was the poet at Queen's, Professor George Wally?
That's right, yes. Very remarkable man.
Yes, he is. So there we are in what month and what year?
That was in July 1940. I joined HMCS Brunswicker. And after about a month's wait, I was sent to sea in August. I mean, almost literally sent to sea. I went to Halifax, spent 10 days in the garret at Admiralty House, getting kitted out and learning how to salute and with which hand, and then joined HMS Rajputana, our merchant cruiser.
Well, I was in Alonia about the time you were in Rajputana. So, talk about Rajputana.
Well, Rajputana was a P&O liner, and at the beginning of the war she had been sent to Esquimalt, being at the eastern end of her run at the time, in Australia, I guess. Sent to Esquimalt for conversion to an armed merchant cruiser. There she had one funnel removed, which lay around the Esquimalt dockyard for a long, long time. All her stately furniture from her staterooms removed. And she was fitted with 8 6-inch guns, Mark 9 guns on a P-3 mount, which dated from 1893 to 1897. Two 4-inch anti-aircraft guns from 1914, and 8 depth charges. That was it.
Yeah. What was your hold filled with?
Oh, the hold was filled, as was the wont with AMCs, with empty 42-gallon oil drums. They used to tell us that the theory was that if you got torpedoed, instead of sinking, you rose a foot. This turned out not to be true.
Yes, as we hear presently. And the officers are mostly R&R?
The officers were a strange mixture. There were a few RCM, and I beg your pardon, RN, a few Royal Navy. The captain, for instance, was a Royal Navy.
Did he live? What's his name?
His name is... I don't know what his real name was, but he was always called Nosey Taylor. He had a prominent nose, that's why.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure, I think he was a retired captain. He might have been, yes, I'm sure he was a retired captain.
And he came back with his four rings.
And he came back with his four rings in command of this ship. Her master was also still aboard as the commander. He was R&R.
Dan, I have memories of you being R&R. You weren't. You were R&R.
No, I was RCMVR.
Yeah. I guess I'm thinking of Hansen.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
All right. That was the captain. The commander was RN.
The commander was RN. There was another commander who was... They had two commanders, is what it amounts to. Commander Schofield, and I can't remember the name of the other one. One was an RN executive officer, who was the real commander of the ship. The other was the ship's previous master, who became the sort of navigating commander.
Well, we had that too in Alonia. That's what I mean when you say you can't remember the name of the other XO. Alec Douglas's researchers have got Navy lists. So they'll fill it in if they want it.
The rest of the officers were mostly RNR, either regular RNR or T-124X, which was a special arrangement, wartime arrangement.
Excuse me, I just want to hear. T-124, yeah. The ratings were a lot, mostly T-124s, weren't they?
Yes, they were. Practically the whole of the original ship's company had come in on that agreement.
Yeah.
Then they had 24 Canadian Stokers, which they'd picked up on the West Coast, I think it was 24, and a number of RCMVR officers, including Commander Joe Connolly, and 8 of us midshipmen. They had been operating on the West Coast in the very early days of the war, on the West Coast of South America, Talcahuana, and so on.
Do you mind spelling that for us? We'll never forget it. Where is it? The West Coast of Mexico.
It's the West Coast of Peru or Chile.
Peru.
I think, yeah.
Try it.
T-A-L-C-A-U-H. N. Oh.
That's close enough. When Alan and I first heard of Wei Hai Wei from Pat Budge, we looked all over China until we found it. It's just a way of shortening our research time. Okay, that's close enough. We'll find it and spell it correctly for you.
Anyway, she had then been sent around to the East Coast, and during a long and tedious voyage, it hatched the plot of taking 8 Canadian midshipmen for training as being a contribution to the war effort they could make. And so 8 of us were selected from all across the country, I think basically on the grounds of which school we'd been to. There were 2 from St. John.
And you were where, did you tell me? I've forgotten. School?
Rothsay Collegiate.
Rothsay, yeah.
Rothsay, New Brunswick.
It was very much the old boy private school net.
Mm-hmm. There were 2 from St. John, 1 from Montreal, 2 from Winnipeg, 1 from Vancouver. I forget now. 1 from Toronto, and I think the other one was Calgary.
Anybody who subsequently became either notorious or famous?
I don't think. Yes, actually.
Except yourself, of course, who became famous. I hasten to the end.
There was Ken Meredith, who became a judge in the British Columbia Courts. I don't know what happened to most of the rest of them. Murray Cook joined the regular force and retired at the end of his time to become a turkey farmer in Hampshire. Yeah. Ian Chenoweth was another.
Yeah. Well, he was on our small end with us.
Right. Doug Gardner from Winnipeg. Graham Gower from Winnipeg, I think. Johnny Clark from Toronto. And I'm just having a momentary lapse while I think of my friend from St. John who was killed.
That'll pop up later, I'll remember. So you joined her and you went where?
Dry dock in St. John, New Brunswick. We were there for quite an extensive refit period before we finally got to sea. It must have been a couple of months, I think.
So what date are we up to now?
We're up, we must be up to about December, I think. Yes, late November.
November?
1940.
November 40, right.
And we then came back to Halifax and started on what we used to call, we called it the Triangle Run. It's not the same as the later Triangle Run. This one was from Halifax to Bermuda, to the mid-ocean meeting point, or whatever they called it in those days, where they handed the little convoy over to the main body, and then back to Halifax.
Did a capital ship take over from you at the mid-ocean meeting point?
Yes, is the answer to that. Sometimes the capital ships were mostly used to escort troop convoys
yes.
in those very early days. Revenge, Ramillies, all that.
What kind of ships took over from you then? besides, what did you get, cruisers?
As far as I simply do not recall,
yeah.
I'm afraid. I saw so little of them
in the middle
of the convoy.
They're all on record. And any destroyers?
I cannot recall what they
escorted. Because our own destroyers only went out a few days with you.
That's correct. They only went out for a couple of days. And there again, they usually escorted the troop convoys that had the primary.
Were you seeing any... Let me see, where are we? November 40, well, you were seeing corvettes then.
We took the first corvettes, Eyebright, Arrowhead, and so on, out with us from Halifax. I've never forgotten the wooden guns, because they were drooping slightly at that stage of the game. They were pretty obviously wood.
Yeah.
Those poor little things, we used to see them out on the wings of the convoy from time to time as they arose above the waves.
Yes.
And never did know what happened to them until much later.
So from November 40 on out to the mid-ocean meeting point of these convoys, for how long?
That went on until just before she was sunk. Mm-hmm. We used to enjoy the time in Bermuda, but I remember one time going from Bermuda to the mid-ocean meeting point. We got into the latter half of a hurricane, I suppose, but that 18,000-ton ship rolled 52 degrees.
Did it? By gosh.
Which was quite an experience for a young fellow like myself.
Yeah.
The grand piano cast adrift in the wardroom and pinned the commander in a corner. Luckily, catty corner. He was unscratched. But it was pretty exciting.
What did you say about catty corner?
Catty corner.
What's that?
Well, you know, if you've got a corner.
Yeah.
Diagonally across the corner.
Oh, that's a catty corner. C-A-T-T-Y.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that term. Well, I got a very peculiar idea of life at sea, because when I was a midshipman in August 39, my first accommodation at Amberley House was in that big bedroom all by myself, and the chief steward brought me a cup of tea in the morning, and I thought, well, this is all right. Then after various things, I went to an AMC where I had a first-class double cabin to myself and that lovely wardroom with the tapestries still on the walls, not the bulkheads, the walls. And you lived in similar luxury.
Very similar, yes. We were in a double cabin. I was in a double cabin with Murray Cook, as I recall.
Yeah.
And although, yes, it was heaven for a midshipman, as a matter of fact, because although we were not allowed to drink spirits, we had quite a generous allowance of wine and beer, which we enjoyed to the hilt.
Tell me about the training for the midshipmen. The
training for the midshipmen was excellent. The Snoddy's nurse, the lieutenant commander in charge of midshipmen, was Lieutenant Commander Dunkley, who eventually became commodore of the P&O line. A neat, compact, strong-minded, black-bearded, excellent R&R officer. And he made quite sure that we had education which was quite as good as they got on subs courses in the regular Navy.
Yeah.
Up at 5:20 in the morning for 30 brisk minutes of PT, cold bath, a shower, plunge into the swimming pool. breakfast.
When Pat Budge went swimming, there was an old hulk tied up. He was at a wooden training ship, boys training ship, and there was a wooden hulk astern. They allowed the seawater to seep into. That was his bath.
And then all day long, all sorts of military exercises, gun drill on the 6-inch guns, limited fire control equipment we had, which consisted of a numeric.
And something that just pointed it, I think. Yeah.
And so forth. Navigation, a great deal of navigation, being a merchant ship. They expected each one of us to become very proficient in navigation. And also, interestingly enough, ship stability and cargo loading, cargo stowage, much more so than the regular Navy ever got.
I don't think they ever got it. Nobody that I've interviewed, RCN entry, has ever mentioned it.
But it was extremely interesting. They made us keep journals. We were treated like regular midshipmen.
Yeah.
Very well done. And then, of course, after a full day's work, we then had to stand night watches, which as a raw young man of 19 years old, I found quite exhausting. not going to sleep on the bridge was one of my more difficult problems at night.
Well, that's the training, that's the officers. The food was excellent because you had your peacetime chief steward.
The food was very good. The chief steward at the time was an ex-Belgian gentleman by the name of Mastboom. Mastboom, it seemed to be a very suitable name for a sailor.
M-A-S-T-B-O-O-M.
Mastboom.
See, he was still using the peacetime provisions in the...
Well, he had his little network set up too, because he, you know, the system, and you get kickbacks and so on, dealing with food in the merchant service. He had that all set up everywhere he went.
So, should we go on to the sinking? Keep going. I'll answer the door.
Well, just before we were sunk, we had been detached at the mid-ocean meeting point from a convoy, and we. Went to the Denmark Strait between Iceland and Greenland on an anti-blockade runner patrol.
Yeah. Was one of the ships reported to, one of the big German ships reported to be out?
I suppose so. Us midshipmen were not entrusted with any intelligence, but that must have been what it was. It was not a warship, but a merchant ship trying to run the blockade.
Yeah.
It was Easter Sunday, as a matter of fact, 1941, the 13th of March, or was it April? 13th of April, I guess, when the first submarine to get west of Iceland, I suppose, torpedoed us. Just at dawn, the navigator was on the bridge taking his morning sights, just almost finished doing that. Johnny Clark was his navigator's tankie, I think, at the time, was taking the times for him. And the enormous bang went off, and the ship went dead in the water, and the navigator threw his sextant on the deck and jumped up and down on it, screaming, "Bugger it, that's ruined my sights!"
But you must have had some warning of this ship's approach. Which one was it, by the way? I've forgotten. Who sank you?
I can't remember the name of the U-boat. The rumor at the time was that it had been Günter Prien.
Yeah.
It wasn't. Oh. But what number it was is in the histories.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I don't recall.
No.
But it was pretty exciting because nobody had expected submarines that far west at that time.
You're in the Denmark Strait.
Yeah. We were in the Denmark Strait, just about halfway between Iceland and Greenland. The water temperature was 42, the air temperature was only 32, so that it was quite chilly for those who eventually ended up in the water and were gotten out.
Describe your getting off the ship. Where were you when the torpedo hit?
When the torpedo hit, I was about to arise from my bunk, I think, as I recall, because there was this phenomenal noise of the alarm bells, which were battery-operated. And all the lights and everything else in the ship went out because they'd hit us dead in the engine room. It was a beautiful shot. Hit us midships on the port side. Immediately stopped the engines, the generators, and every piece of equipment in the engine room. And so we were groping about in the dark trying to find our way out. We got to action stations. The submarine's periscope was sighted from time to time. We fired a gun every minute or so in the general direction of the ocean in order to discourage him, which it didn't. And after several hours, I don't remember how long, I think it must have been 3 or 4 hours, he got tired of watching us sit there and came round to the starboard side and torpedoed us again. Excellent shot, right on the bulkhead between the engine room and number 3 hold, which therefore blew the whole engine room and the hold into one big space. At that stage of the game, it was pretty obvious that she was going to sink. The effect of the torpedoing on the people wasn't, by and large, too bad. She was such a big ship. A number of the stokers were lost in the engine room,
yeah.
In the RAs. And a few people suffered severe shock. Murray Cook, was in bed with a case of, in his bunk on the starboard side of the ship, with a nasty case of German measles at that stage, in quarantine. And Murray awoke to find he could look out the side of the ship. His outside bulkhead had been rolled back for some feet. And he rose rather rapidly and went on deck, where I met him, and there wasn't a spot on him.
The German measles had disappeared?
The German measles had disappeared with the German torpedo, instantaneously.
I think Dr. Douglas had better pass this tape to the medical authorities, don't you?
Well, it was a very interesting case of something. He did get an injury of the inner ear, though, in the shock, which haunted him for quite some time. Frankie Johnson was the name of the midshipman who joined up with me. And,
the one you couldn't remember
the
previously.
I couldn't remember previously.
I knew it would pop up.
And he was from St. John, New Brunswick. And he was severely shocked. Well, we didn't know it at the time. He didn't appear to be so. But he was. He had a nasty case of shock.
Yeah. And he I don't know what shock looks like. He wasn't acting like strange or anything.
Well, slightly. He was dazed, I should... a bit dazed, it seemed. But when the eventual order came to abandon ship, Frankie disappeared, and I was told he'd last been seen climbing the ladder on the funnel. And he was lost.
Oh?
I never did know exactly what happened to poor Frank.
But it wasn't from physical injuries?
Didn't appear to be. Didn't appear to be. There was no external sign of injury on him.
Strange, isn't it?
It really is, yes. And
strange. I heard a soldier friend told me he was doing house-to-house fighting in France, and he came around a corner and something exploded. And he said, I was naked. Every bit of clothing was blown off my body, and I didn't have a bruise. Medical science, anything can't explain things like that. But anyway, that poor shipmate of yours was lost. And you took to the boats in a fairly orderly fashion. I remember 40 years ago you telling me you went back to get some gear in your cabin before you took to the boat.
That is correct, yes. It became obvious she was sinking. She was sinking slowly, but the damage control parties could not keep up with the flow of water. All these empty oil drums were coming out the hole in the starboard side of the ship and floating away down the Denmark Strait, with the boys on the after gun deck singing Roll Out the Barrel at the top of their voices, which I thought was pretty noble under the circumstances.
That's very good, Roll Out the Barrel.
Unfortunately, the ship had a very pronounced list by now to port, and one of the loaded lifeboats caught on something on the way down on the starboard side and turned over, dumped about 60 to 80 men into the water, and then fell heavily on top of them. That's where I think a lot of our losses occurred. The oil fuel, of course, was Bunker C, and was beginning to spread by this time over the surface of the water. And a number of the people that we did pull out, get into the boats, eventually died of asphyxiation, you know, oil spreading on the surface of their lungs. In Iceland, where we were taken.
Well, we better start talking about who picked you up.
Well, we sailed around, pulled in the boats in the general direction of Iceland for a very considerable length of time, it seemed to me. We were actually in the boats about 11 or 12 hours, I think. And by the grace of God and the forethought of the Admiralty, the ship had been provided with a battery-powered emergency transmitter, and had remained to the end. The chief tell had remained issuing SOS in the ship's position, and it was picked up in Iceland.
Did the chief tell get off?
I cannot recall. I think so.
Probably.
I think so. It was picked up in Iceland, and the most beautiful sight I have ever seen, a Sunderland flying boat found us after about 6 or 7 hours.
Any trouble with discipline in the boats?
Absolutely none. It was marvelous. Yeah. It was interesting, you know, there was a very strict hierarchy in the Navy in those days. An executive midshipman took precedence over an engineer commander when it came to actually running something of a seaman-like nature. That was the only thing that didn't work in the event. The man who took charge of our boat, by every right, was an engineer sub-lieutenant who was a great sailor. And it just sort of automatically sorted out.
Everybody looked at him.
Everybody looked at him, and there he was in command. Yes. He was very good. As the afternoon wore on, the sea got up and started slopping down the backs of all us chaps who were busily pulling these great oars and these 60-passenger lifeboats. None of them had engines, of course. So it got to be fairly uncomfortable. Finally, over the horizon, hove two destroyers. HMS Legion was the British one, and there was a Pole. I think it was Bliskavica, but I can't remember exactly.
Bliskavica or Piorun?
Piorun,
yeah. Tribal.
Probably Piorun, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, she screened us while she screened Legion while Legion picked us up. We discovered to our great discomfort when we got on board that Legion's ASDIC was broken down.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore we were completely dependent on Piorun to prevent a repetition of this late unpleasantness. I blame most of my bad habits on those times, from that time. Once they got us on board, in typical British efficient fashion, they removed anything useful from our persons, such as our revolvers or our damage control headlamps, but gave us a tumbler full of brandy and a cigarette, since which time I've been addicted to both those vices.
And they took you to Reykjavik, I guess?
Yes, we went into Reykjavik. The supply officers had managed to get off most of the cash in the ship, so we were eventually...
Supply officers always do.
Eventually. Well, they have strict orders about this, I suppose.
I don't know why. It's only money, and if you know it's gone, then you just replace it, but...
Well, I was glad he had, because we all got a £5 advance on our pay. And we're allowed loose to go into Reykjavik once they made quite certain we were all right. That was splendid, because not only could you buy Danish pastries and things of that nature, but we found the telegraph office, and although the island was sort of under British occupation at that time, nobody had thought to introduce censorship on the local telegraph office. So we were able to telegraph home, cable home, and tell our parents that we were okay. I remember I sent quite a short signal to them saying, sunk, saturated, saved, love, damn.
What did you say?
Sunk, saturated, saved, love, damn, which made the rounds at home. Well, okay. That was pretty good.
Were you going with Margot then?
Just met her. I had met her because I was ordered to go to a party by the surgeon commander, who was a great friend of Professor Montgomery's at Dalhousie University. And Professor's daughter was having a thé dansant, as young girls did in those days.
Yes, very elegant.
Very elegant, and the girls were all very young, and we midshipmen knew that, and we thought we were pretty old, being 19, 18 and a half, and so on. Fell in and complained. That complaint was turned down at once, and four of us went to Shirley Montgomery's party. By the grace of God, because Margot, having had her date broken by her mother because she wanted her to go to Mrs. Montgomery's party, turned up about an hour late, and I guess it was love at first sight. We were pretty mature. She was 17, and I was 19, and we discussed psychology and other esoteric matters the 15-year-olds were in no condition to talk about.
Yeah.
And never looked back after that, but that had been the only time. And it wasn't until after I got back from my sinking that we really got to know each other well.
There's a point that I'll interject here. Alma knew Margot in those days, and I was going with Alma, and I married her, and Margot was here, and Alma's here. We were a marrying group, and every wife I've met so far is the girlfriend that the fellow was taking out 40 years ago.
Yes, yes. I think our marriages, by and large, have lasted. It's extraordinarily well.
Yeah.
It was a function of the times, I suppose.
Yeah.
It really was important what we were doing. We felt
well, the girls
important.
Were very, they were gung-ho as we were.
They were tremendous.
I'd hate to mention the word patriotism today in my classes at UVic, but and I don't suppose they used that word, but they certainly felt that way, and maybe the young girls would have said, we're speculating now, I'm wondering. Before I go back to you in Reykjavik, you're mentioning Pioran brought it up. I've heard stories all my life, and I've never heard any man say, I saw it, about the fact that the Poles were much more bitter against the Germans than we were. Quite naturally, their homeland was occupied. And I've heard stories about Polish destroyers arriving in St. John's with U-boat survivors swinging from the yardarm. Have you heard those stories?
I've heard the stories too, but I also never saw it. When I first joined Skeena, which was after I had my survivor's leave, after I was sent, and they had come back, of course, from the evacuations and things, they claimed, Jimmy Hibbard, who was captain at the time, claimed to have seen a Polish destroyer going, backing down and going ahead through.